Our world's capacity to feed itself is dependent on science and technology, which is true whether we're talking billions of calories for a growing population or organic produce from our own backyards. But the simple act of talking about food and science can be challenging for scientists, communicators, and consumers. Ohio State University addressed those challenges in a recent forum, and three of the meeting's principals made time to share their thoughts with you today on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
The Truth About Food, the Role of Science in Public Affairs Journalism, was the title of a recent conference hosted by the Food Innovation Center. And it drew some first-rate speakers who graciously agreed to sit down with us today. Joining us on Town Hall Ohio today is Nina Teicholz. She is an investigative journalist and author of the International and New York Times bestseller, The Big Fat Surprise. It was named best book by sources as varied as The Wall Street Journal and Mother Jones. She also has an impressive journalism resume, including her work at National Public Radio. She's contributed to The Journal, The New York Times, The Economist, and other renowned publications, and she has a master's degree from Oxford. Earl Holland was the Senior Science and Medical Communications Officer at Ohio State University, overseeing communications involving areas of research risks such as biosafety, radiation safety, research using lab animals or humans, fraud, misconduct, and a lot of the other non-controversial topics that will come up. And for more than two decades, he taught graduate courses in science writing and science communications, was a longtime columnist on science and medicine for both the Columbus Dispatch and the New York Times Syndicate. Ken Lee is Director of Food Innovation at Ohio State, Advancing the Human Condition with Food, twice elected chair of the steering committee that sets the University Senate agenda, published 75 scholarly papers, past president of the Food Science Honorary, and was elected a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2015. So Nina and Earl, welcome to Town Hall, Ohio.
Hi, great to be here.
Ken will be joining us shortly. He got tied up because we're recording this ahead of that session I mentioned, and he's quite busy. So we'll talk a little bit more about the conference in a little bit. But Nina, just a very broad question for you to get the conversation started. If I'm right that it's tough to converse about food, A, am I right? B, why?
Yes, it's tough to converse about food because it is, in addition to being a deeply personal issue, everybody has to eat three times a day. You can't ignore it. It's also an area where there is basically wars going on at the level of scientific, the scientific community, where there's tremendous disagreement about what is a healthy diet. So people are caught in the midst of that, and journalists trying to make sense of that, the public trying to make sense of that, all of that is confusing and really difficult for people.
Earl, you sat on the opposite side of when Nina would call as a journalist. Your reaction to the difficulty level, the degree of difficulty.
Well, I think not to be opposing to that, to what Nina said, but I do think that it's not that hard to talk about food. Everybody seems to be doing it. I think the hard part is to get accurate information, as Nina's found out many, many times. The public has such conflicting views and conflicting information about food that I think it becomes a challenge to determine what is accurate and what is useful.
So as we proceed through this show, and I imagine in other conversations, it might be of some value to go back to my very first communications class in college, and they teach you the simple matrix of message, medium, and receiver. As we get into the show deeper and explore how we might be able to make food communication better. Nina, is it accurate to say that the messaging, the person that gives that message, the person that receives that message, all of us need to maybe rethink how we do things better?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, the way that I see it is at the very top level are the people delivering the message, but nobody agrees on the message, right? You've got the vegan diet doctors, you have the paleo people, you have the expert community saying one thing and another thing. So the message is confused. Then you have the translators trying to translate these confused messages. By the time you get to the public, you know, they're just completely confused and kind of whiplashed by all these sort of back and forth headlines. So I think the problem is there's not one message because there's no one right diet. There's a desperate desire for like one perfect solution, one ideal optimal diet. But that really just doesn't exist for a tremendously diverse population.
Well, I think that last point that there's not one specific route for a solution for these things. That's primarily because the public is so diverse from that standpoint, and not only are they diverse in their needs, but they're also diverse in their interests. What they respond to, what kind of information they respond to. We talk a lot about getting the message out, but from my experience, it's always been more important to find out what message the public is receptive to, how the public will respond to different messages, different frames of information, and deal with them accordingly.
Can I just add to that? Because the other way in which people are different is, of course, you know, food is cultural, right? There's tremendous cultural diversity in our country. It's one way that culture is transmitted through generations, right? The recipes of your grandmother, the recipes of your great grandma, and all of that is part of the culture that you inherit. So why should we all be Mediterranean? You know, what if you're Swedish? You know, why should we all be eating the same food? And so there's tremendous, I mean, that is a diversity that should be respected.
There are also a lot of conflicts. I mean, and when you talk about your grandmother's recipes, which we all wish we could still reproduce, our concerns today about personal health and well-being and body image and things along those lines are substantially different from how they were in our grandparents' times and the like. And so there is a kind of natural disconnect between, hey, my grandparents ate this way, a way which I would never eat in modern times, and yet they seem to fare fairly well. So why is that? I just think there's a lot of open questions that we haven't been able to address yet that have a lot to do with culture, that have a lot to do with our personal history, and have a lot to do with the how much we're inundated with conflicting messages.
Earl Holland, a science communicator, primarily through his career at The Ohio State University. Nina Teicholz is a food author and journalist. And Ken Lee was done getting ready for the program, got in to join us for the show. Ken, welcome back to Town Hall, Ohio.
Hey, Joe, my apologies for sneaking in here late.
Not a problem at all.
You know, Ohio State's under construction, so that might be the garage.
So I want to come back to the conversation, but to help us get things set up going forward, I mentioned we recorded this prior to a conference that your team hosted called The Truth About Food, The Role of Science in Public Affairs Journalism. What was the purpose of the conference?
Well, you know, I just can tell from the context of the discussion, we pretty much established that food is such a tough thing that everyone does every day. It's very intimate, three times a day, perhaps continually throughout the day. So everybody has an opinion about food, but the discussion that we just had about dietary diversity is very important. Just like any one physician wouldn't prescribe any particular drug for everyone for the same ailment, nor should we have the same food as a solution for everyone. I really like that idea that now as we become more culturally diverse and ethnically diverse, the food is becoming more diverse. And we in food science always like to say moderation variety is really the keys to good health and good living.
So Earl and Nina were your two primary speakers at the conference. Nina, you've done a lot in your career, most recently and maybe most famously is the book called The Big Fat Surprise. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to put it in the context of the conversation that we've just been having, which is that we're all arguing for kind of a diversity of diets, and I believe in that. But we do, this is all a conversation happening against this extremely stark reality of more than half, you know, two-thirds of the nation being obese or overweight, and more than half the country being pre-diabetic, right, or diabetic. And So, and the really obvious question is, you know, why is that happening? Why it's all pretty much happened since 1980. So my book really went after looked at the fundamental advice for fighting disease. You know, it really started out with heart disease, and then it became obesity and diabetes, as those grew to be, you know, chief killers. And what I discovered was, that nutrition science is just rife with politics, that politics have driven this our nutrition policy much more than the science itself. But the science itself really never supported the idea that a low-fat diet was good for health, that restricting total fat was good, or that saturated fats, the kind of fats in meat, butter, dairy, eggs, cheese, that those fats cause heart disease. There was never good science. It was tested in huge clinical trials, really rigorous science, and could never be confirmed. And yet we still live with this idea that is basically hanging on due to sort of entrenched bias and, you know, industry support and institutional support. And so that's the part of my book that was hugely controversial, because that's one of the pillars of our dietary advice going back really to the 1960s.
You don't necessarily need to name names unless you want to, but the idea that animal proteins are really bad for us, where'd that come from? If it's not sound science.
Well, the whole it all started in the 1950s when heart disease, the rising tide of heart disease had risen from pretty much out of nowhere in the early 1900s to become the number one killer in the nation. And President Eisenhower had a heart attack in 1955, is out of the Oval Office for 10 days. Imagine. So the whole nation is in a panic. What causes heart disease? And there was there were a number of ideas, but basically one scientist prevailed. His name is Ansel Keys. I don't mind naming his name. He was a pathologist at the University of Minnesota, and he came up with the idea that saturated fat and cholesterol, found mainly in animal foods, clogged the arteries, raised your cholesterol, and caused heart attacks. And that idea, he was this very kind of outsized individual who had an unshakable faith in his own beliefs and was able to argue anyone to the point of you know, to prove his point. And he was able to get his idea implanted into the American Heart Association. So really the very first recommendation to avoid saturated fat and cholesterol started with the American Heart Association recommendation in 1961. That's what I like to call it, you know, the tiny acorn that grew into the giant oak tree of advice that we have today, and that of governments and the WHO and every official organization has adopted worldwide. It really all started there with Ansel Keys. But there was never science for that 1961 recommendation. And as I said, his hypothesis was tested more than any other nutrition hypothesis in the history of nutrition science on more than 60,000 people in highly controlled trials, and they could not show him to be right. In fact, some of those trials found that the people who ate saturated fats, the more they lowered their cholesterol, the higher rates of heart disease they suffered from.
Nina Teicholz is a journalist and the author of the book, The Big Fat Surprise. Earl Holland is a science communicator, longtime at Ohio State University, and OSU food scientist Ken Lee, all our guests today on the show. We recorded this backstage in the auditorium at the Ohio Union. It was a precursor to a recent session put on by Ohio State called The Truth About Food. We will be back in just a couple of moments to talk more with Nina, Earl, and Ken on Town Hall, Ohio. Communication let me down, and I'm left here. Communication let me down, and I'm left here again. We are back on Town Hall, Ohio, program recorded right before a session at Ohio State a little while back called The Truth About Food, The Role of Science in Public Affairs Journalism. Helping us tell that story, Ken Lee, food scientist at Ohio State University, Earl Holland, a science communicator, now retired, and Nina Teicholz, who is food author and journalist, and among other things, you may recognize Nina's name and voice from years on National Public Radio. Nina was telling us a little bit about her research into the science that meat products will kill us. She didn't phrase it that way. That's my phrasing. Ken, you were going to comment there.
Well, actually, Joe, you started off with a question, why is the Food Innovation Center so interested in this? And that's really the program to bring Nina to campus to speak about the truth about food, because she's got a message that's very important as we evolve into the next series of dietary guidelines for America, which of course at one time talked about eating low fat, low cholesterol. Of course, we dropped those recommendations because they proved to not be true. And I have to really admire Nina for her for many decades of investigative journalism to really get to the bottom of this. And she started off talking about Anson Keyes. He was the fellow that had that famous plot of heart disease rate and dietary fat intake across the world. And he pretty much showed a straight line. As your fat intake went up, your heart disease rates went up. But kind of lost in that initial flurry of attention in the press was his theories were later debunked, because he actually selectively picked those countries and left out the countries that made it look like a shotgun scatterplot. But he was so enamored with that hypothesis, and it became a dietary guideline, or actually a dietary goal, and Senator McGovern made dietary goals for America. It got written into congressional record by people who were really not very well trained in science.
Earl, you spent a career working in communicating scientific principles and such. Nina made the point earlier on that sometimes politics trump science. Trump's science? Did you ever run across that?
Oh, no, never. never in 40 years of doing this would I have something like that. I do think there's one thing that often gets lost in the conversation, and that's the realization that the kinds of information that we direct to the public, either as researchers or as journalists conveying research findings or something, tend to fall into two possible categories. When you're talking about medical reporting, for example, one of the most famous medical journalists in the country, Vic Cohn from the Washington Post, used to say there were two kinds of medical stories, new hope or no hope. And I think the same can be said, or something similar can be said, for stories about food research. In fact, this is either good for you or it's bad for you. And we've gotten the public acclimatized to those two types of stories. What's bad about that is the fact that most research is never that clear. Research findings are shared, and there are all sorts of caveats and qualifications and parameters to those findings. And that's the kind of information that's never conveyed to the public. And it's not just the journalist's fault. The journalists are dealing with a limited amount of space or time or airtime to deliver the information, and so some of it gets lost. But also the public's not that receptive to qualified information. And I think one of the major challenges is, how do we get the public to look at information that flows in its direction about research and understand it's not a black and white situation? There's a whole lot of gray involved. And start asking about those types of, what are the parameters that are not included in this information? What are the kinds of caveats that apply to these kinds of findings? So they get a clearer picture of what the research actually tells them.
Actually, Earl, you're making a great point, because the science is often misconstrued or misunderstood to be facts and truth. But actually, the process of science is a conversation based on evidence. So I have a bit of evidence, and the journalist will report it, but it's not definitive. It's an ongoing conversation.
That along with the fact that people generally don't understand, and it would be unfair to expect them to understand specifically the kind of gradation of research projects that are underway. What type of a study is more qualified to give a result or a finding or a causality than another one? Observational studies are very, very big in food science, and those are studies which, when reinterpreted for the public, often end up suggesting a causality. But in reality, an observational study can never show a causality.
So I want to jump in here and say something heretical, which is that, and this is a fundamental point that you're making, which is that there are observational studies which show association. Something is associated with something else. And then there are randomized controlled clinical trials, or any kind of clinical trial, which it's the only kind of study that can really show cause and effect. But So observational studies are really weak. Randomized controlled clinical trials are strong enough if you have a good enough set number of them to make, you know, policy recommendations. But getting back to the studies, you know, does meat kill us? Do animal proteins kill us? All of that is based on epidemiological studies, right? Not rigorous data. And I have to add that they are pumped out of university press offices as if they are rigorous data, which is to add another dimension here.
Well, Nina just used a $20 word, epidemiology, science of coincidence. So it's just really correlates. It's not cause and effect.
Ohio State food scientist Ken Lee, Nina Teicholz, author of the book Big Fat Surprise, Earl Holland, science communicator, retired from Ohio State University, all recorded live on campus ahead of a session on the truth about food, science, communication, and public affairs journalism. We'll be back to talk more with Ken, Earl, and Nina when we continue on Town Hall Ohio. Back to Town Hall, Ohio. We're talking about food, communication, science, and how do we improve that across the communication spectrum. Helping us with that are Earl Holland, a science communicator, Ken Lee, food scientist, and Nina Teicholz. She's a food author and journalist and author of the book, Big Fat Surprise. Nina, we've been talking about people, and Earl made the point that we shouldn't be trained scientists. We shouldn't be expected to be. But we still need to understand some basic scientific principles. I want to move off that for a moment. Even if we understand the science, many people seem inclined to not care, that they don't make certain choices in their lives based on data. They base it on feeling and emotion. Is that correct? Do you see that as you try to communicate to people about science?
Yeah, I mean, there's many angles to that, right? One is going back to this idea that food is really cultural. Food is something that people, they have a personal feelings about. It's about their family, their heritage, and they don't want to move from that. If they see data, they're inclined at this point to not trust it because, as we've been talking about, all the flip-flopping headlines and all the contrary information. So there's a kind of weariness, I think, about nutrition science and data that has affected people. And third, some people are just, I think in the last decade or so, you have seen kind of a passionate upsurge of people who really believe in food as a kind of a whole, almost like a quasi-religious movement, you know, towards like wanting to get their food locally, which I think is wonderful. But, you know, maybe some less wonderful aspects are, you know, there's incredible vegan activism that is really motivated by not by food, but about the environment, about social welfare, about animal welfare. So those passions are stemming from a different place in people, but are very powerful. And I think that is maybe one of the most distinctive features of how the food kind of conversation has changed in the last decade or so.
There's in the last decade, it's just not an emerging set of feelings on people's part. In the last decade, there's been a substantial body of work in the social sciences that has looked at this question of why do people, when confronted with information to the contrary, believe a certain way? And the gist of all of that body of work is that people who have preset beliefs in something are only strengthened when they are given facts to the contrary, which is a really, really strange situation and a very, very challenging thing for people who want to impart information based on fact and research. So that's we see that in climate change, we see that in a host of other controversial areas. It's certainly clear that we see it in looking at food science and the research involving food science.
Errol, your point is actually very, very good, because in today's internet conversation, that's even exacerbated, whereas your current belief structure is going to be reinforced because the way the internet is working is it gives you other opinions that are consistent with your belief structure. So if you do a Google search on a food belief and I do a Google search on a food belief, I get different information.
Exactly.
Even though we're using the same computer
Exactly, because it's based, because the algorithms are based on what your previous searches have been and things along that line. But the key thing here is a fundamental question. If we have good food research, and we're assuming we have good food research,
big assumption.
How do we get the public to understand that? What's been my experience? You asked a couple of minutes ago about looking back in my career on the thing. The democratization of the web has changed the way we get information. All information is almost equal at this point in time, and the quality control that used to be with conventional media is pretty much gone now.
I guess at one time you had an editor who sat in the newsroom that said, hey, this is factual or this is bunk.
Exactly.
But now we have a machine doing it.
Yeah, but in the food world, there's this amazing paradox, which is that the best and most current science, because it contradicts it really contradicts the low-fat establishment view. So you have a situation where this best and most current science is only being talked about on the internet, really. I mean, that is where the communities of people are finding this science. They're finding it reverses their diabetes. It helps them lose weight. And so there is this kind of like, this is actually a kind of a groundswell movement that couldn't have happened without the internet. So what a bizarre paradox that is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the established media that refuses to report on this science.
And what is really unusual about that is that one of the primary aspects of journalism is conflict. And more news value is more often than not based on something that's contrary to an accepted norm. And so when you have a situation where the research is trying to disprove something, or the research data actually does disprove something, you would think that the conventional media would jump all over that because it's a great news story. But as Nina has said, often that is just not the case.
It's a bizarre situation. In nutrition journalism, it is truly bizarre. And I think it's in part because many of the top journalists have written books, taken a stand on the subject, and they do not want to back out of their views.
Very interesting conversation. I like it when I don't have to talk. I can just listen. We'll be back to listen to Nina, Earl, and Ken right after this. Town Hall, Ohio, talking about the communication of food and food science, following up on a conference held recently at The Ohio State University entitled The Truth About Food, The Role of Science in Public Affairs Journalism. Nina Teicholz, food author and journalist, is with us today, as is Earl Holland, a retired, longtime science communicator. Ken Lee runs the Food Innovation Center at The Ohio State University and is a food scientist himself. So I want to spend a couple of minutes. We've kind of gotten down that path a little bit about the translators. When a food scientist such as Ken does something, there's a reporter such as Nina that's going to translate that, and I, as the reader, am going to get my knowledge of what Ken did based on what Nina writes or reports on the radio. As you look at the journalism piece of this, how are we doing, Earl? Are we? I assume there's some room for improvements there.
Yes, there's always room for improvement in journalism. Nina made the point that many of the best journalists or many of the top journalists have written books which have established their position on a number of questions involving food science or other areas of science. That's accurate, but the problem with that is that books are not the way that the public receives even a small portion of the information that they garner. Books take a long time to write, and they take a long time to read as far as the public is concerned. The attention span of the public has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And so that presents a challenge for the journalist involved, and being a former journalist, I'm sympathetic to that. and given the economic strife that journalists now deal with as well, there are a lot more things that are asked of the journalist now than the traditional role of just providing information.
So, Nina, one of the points I often make when I'm having this conversation with folks is that know the difference between sound journalism and somebody with a keyboard and a mouse. And some of those differences are the vetting process, the editorial process. Is that falling apart too? I mean, if a famous journalist can get away with writing a book that then contradicts their ability to do a good job of reporting, is the system breaking down somewhat?
You know, I think that there are certain really strong fixed ideas that have taken hold for the last 50 years in nutrition science. One of that the low-fat diet works, that it's all about calories in, calories out. You should avoid, butter and cheese and especially meat to be healthy. Those ideas are just pervasive. Almost all journalists, every nutrition writer that's written a book has written a book that sort of more or less confirms those ideas, right? So, and they don't see themselves as biased. They feel like they're reflecting the science. And then I come along with a book that says exactly the opposite, and everybody says, you're too biased now to write about the subject. I am biased. I have a view of what the science says. But we're all biased in this, right? Those journalists at top newspapers and magazines, they're also biased. They just don't realize it, because when you have a bias that is the conventional wisdom, then it doesn't seem like a bias. It's just like what everybody thinks. So
I think we actually have a very good point here. We need to just return to the fact that we have an epidemic of obesity in the United States today, and perhaps other countries as well. And the reason we got there is because of this bias that you're talking about, where the nutrition community in particular, and somewhat the food science community, to which I am a member, has bought into this idea that a low-fat, higher-carb diet is good, but in fact, it's the opposite of the truth. We need a lower carb, higher fat diet in order to control the epidemic of obesity in the United States. Mm-hmm. It is a all hands on deck situation right now, because if we can control obesity, we've really reduced healthcare costs. We've improved life quality for many, many people. And so the time is right now to actually do something about this. And I'm so glad that we're having this conversation.
So we will only have about 30 seconds here, Earl, for you to start this piece of the conversation, but just kind of maybe set it up for us. Yeah. So what can guys like Ken do better? What do we need to help? People are wired to do certain things. Scientists do science because it's what they're wired to do. They're not wired to be communicators. How do we start down that path of getting people working in the laboratory to be able to talk to Joe Schmo out on the street corner?
As brief as I can be, the simple fact is the people in Ken's shoes need to learn about the jobs and the challenges of the journalist. They need to start thinking about what the public is interested in. They need to be honest about what are those challenges that the public is facing in getting actual fact across.
We'll be back to wrap up our conversation about communicating food and food science when we continue on Town Hall Ohio. Ken Lee, who is a food scientist at Ohio State, Nina Teicholz, food author and journalist, and the author of the book, The Big Fat Surprise, and Earl Holland, who spent a career helping to translate science to some extent for the consuming public. Earl, you mentioned there were some things that scientists could do to become better communicators, to get their information through, and had to cut you off for the break. Follow up.
That's all right. I mean, we live in a world that is full of silos. Scientists talk to other scientists and traditionally have not seen as a major part of their role talking to anyone else. Journalists' role have always been to just listen to what a source says and convey it to the public. And the public's role has generally been one to be receptive of things nowadays that they're interested in, and that's all. To solve the problem in a broad sense, I mean, scientists need to stop and think about the communications process. What is the culture of journalism, for example? If they're going to interact with journalists to convey their message, they need to know something about the culture of journalism, how journalism is done. Journalists, on the other hand, can't be ignorant of the way science is done. And the public can't remain ignorant in the way it has in the past. The public needs to invest time and energy in those things. And the thing that has surprised me is the realization that if a member of the public, any of us, are interested in a topic, there is no limit to the amount of energy and attention that we'll pay to that topic.
Is the scientific community open to that suggestion? Do they recognize that, yeah, we could do better in passing information along?
Well, you know, I don't speak for the whole scientific community, nor should I, because we are, in fact, we're as diverse as journalists are, in that we have a whole bunch of different communication styles and different things that motivate us. But the one thing we do have at the university, which is, you know, you have university scientists, government scientists, and industrial scientists. At the university, we have this thing called presumption of integrity. People think that you're working at a university, you're not, you know, selling out to the almighty dollar, which, you know, could be questionable in and of itself. But at least the scientists I know at universities try to say and do the right thing. But the problem we're talking about of communication is we're not trained, nor are we formally trained in any way, on how to communicate to public. And that's where the journalists really come in, because they can actually take a very complex concept and translate it into a level that's comprehensible by most people. And we really do appreciate that.
Speaking of training, you're at the top of your profession as a reporter, Nina. What do you have as the recommendation for the young man or woman just getting out of, well, if we still had J schools, another whole show. That young reporter that just got their first job at the Pataskala Gazette, and they want to do a good job of reporting science, reporting food news. What do they need to know?
You know, I've been thinking about that question in preparation for the conference that we've. But I really think that nutrition journalists need to treat nutrition science. They need to think about it like they're in the reporting on Capitol Hill or at the State House or something. They need to understand this is not a story of dispassionate scientists calmly looking at data and conveying truth. I mean, the reality is, in this field, you know, scientists have got it wrong on the low-fat diet. They got it wrong on cholesterol. They've done a lot of things that they've basically not been conveying accurately the science to. And that's because they're paid off by the food industry or the sugar industry. You know, recently stories about how the sugar industry paid off Harvard scientists. So if you're a reporter, you need to understand there's politics here. Follow the money. Look and see who funded a study. You have to treat this field like any other field of business, which is that it's complex and political and full of money.
Wish we had another hour. We don't. Nina, your book, The Big Fat Surprise, where do folks find that?
On thebigfatsurprise.com. There's information and links to buy it.
And Earl, you're engaged in a food science newsletter, correct?
Well, it's more a health and medical reporting critiquing website. It's called healthnewsreview.org. It's available, and it provides a real-time evaluation of current reporting.
And Ken, where do folks find out more about the Food Innovation Center?
Well, exactly that. Food Innovation Center is fic.osu.edu.
Fascinating show. Thank you all to Nina Teicholz, food author, journalist, Earl Holland, science communicator, Ken Lee, food scientist. Been a very interesting show. Thanks to all of you for listening in today on Town Hall, Ohio.
Town Hall, Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall, Ohio.